Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Vidya Mala Birch, who is the co-founder and director of Breathworks, an organisation whose mission is to bring mindfulness as a tool for reducing suffering to people worldwide, regardless of their situation. Hello, Vidya Mala. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thanks, Barry. It's a real pleasure to be here with you.
Okay. Could we maybe start by talking a little bit about mindfulness and how you became interested in it?
Okay, so mindfulness, in a way, at its most simple definition, you could just say it's awareness.
Uh-huh.
It's a particular quality of awareness where you're very much in your body, in the present moment, and you know what's going on. And out of that awareness, you can then make choices how you respond to your experience. That's putting it very, very simply. So, for example, if you've got physical pain in your body, rather than just living in a state of reacting to the pain automatically, you become aware of it as it's happening. You feel into its, you sort of feel into its nature, which is that rather than it being a fixed lump in your body, it's actually a flow of sensations that are changing moment by moment.
Right.
So you're able to just be with, you're able to be with those basic sensations and unravel all the mental, emotional, and physical reactions that we normally have. Yeah, so that's putting it very, very simply, but I think that's quite a good way of looking at it.
Yeah.
And so going back to physical pain, the model that I've developed is that usually when we're experiencing discomfort, and this also applies to mental pain and stress and so on, it just feels horrible and you just got this thing that you don't like going on in your life or in your body. But if you turn towards the actual experience with awareness, then you can divide it into two components. There's the primary suffering, and then there's the secondary suffering. So the primary suffering are the basic sensations in the case of physical pain, and the secondary suffering are things like anxiety, depression, despair, fear, catastrophic thinking, like, oh my God, you know, it's never going to end, and my life's ruined, and I won't ever have any friends again, and all those kind of things that we naturally do. And secondary physical pain is secondary tension. So you've got discomfort and then you tense against it and you have more discomfort.
Right.
Yeah. So mindfulness is what enables you to sort of unravel all those layers of reactivity, come back to your basic experience, treat that with kindliness and tenderness, and prevent the arising of all the secondary layers of suffering. So you're just left with your primary suffering. And with most people that I've taught and in my own experience, most of our distress is the secondary suffering.
Yeah.
That's much more distressing and much more painful than the basic sensations. So mindfulness is the quality of awareness that we can bring where we kind of wake up to what's actually happening rather than what we think is happening and what we fear may happen in the future. So it's embodied present moment awareness that gives us this gift of choice.
Okay. Yeah.
So the way I got into it is I injured my spine quite badly when I was a teenager, which is a long time ago, and had some major surgeries. And eventually, when I was 25, I was in hospital in an intensive care ward. I was very ill with my condition. And the hospital chaplain came to see me, who was a very lovely gentleman, call him a gentleman, he was really like that. And I wasn't at all religious, so I was not the most receptive candidate. And he held my hand and he got me to remember a time I'd been happy and a place that I'd been happy. And I took my memory back to the southern Alps of New Zealand where I'd done some climbing and been very, very happy. And then he brought me back to the present, and I felt completely different. So I was still the same girl lying in the hospital bed, and yet I felt different because of what I'd done with my mind. So the insight there was that my mind was a tool.
Right.
My awareness was a tool that I could use to change my subjective experience. So that's the visualization sort of meditation, which is different from mindfulness. But that was what got me interested in meditation as a discipline that I could learn.
At that time, in terms of dealing with pain, was there much out there to help you?
There was nothing. No, I was in New Zealand in 1985, and the doctors were saying there was nothing they could do to help me, that I had a disability, I just had to learn to live with it. And there was nothing. You weren't even offered counselling in those days. I had to give up my career. It was quite a devastating time. And there was nothing in terms of mind-body medicine around then. It's really quite remarkable how that's developed over the last 20 years. Yeah. Because, you know, now you can get taught mindfulness in hospitals, but then there was absolutely nothing. So it awoke, my experience with the chaplain awoke a hunger in me where I wanted to learn about my mind. I'd never really considered that I had a mind prior to then. I think often we don't, do we? We just live our lives.
Yeah, yeah.
But this idea that I had a mind that I could learn to train to enable me to change my subjective experience, that was quite awesome. That was remarkable. And then I learned yoga, and then I went on a Buddhist retreat and I learned Buddhist meditation. And then really it's been in the last, probably the last 15 years that I've learned mindfulness meditation in a secular setting, which is mindfulness meditation as applied to chronic health conditions, mental health and things like that. And the reason I do mindfulness as opposed to visualization, for example, like I did with the chaplain, is because I learned that visualization can be very escapist. So even though you're learning to use your mind, you can use it to try and avoid what's actually happening right now.
Right.
Whereas mindfulness meditation is the opposite of that. It's not the least bit escapist. You really are just learning to fully inhabit your life every moment as it's happening. Be fully alive with this tremendous sense of initiative, that no matter what happens, you can always choose how you respond to it. But you can only choose how you respond if you know what's happening, if you're aware of what's happening.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
Okay, and you've recently brought out a new book, haven't you, Vidyamala? Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, yeah, so I brought out a new book on the 5th of September, which is called Mindfulness for Health, A Practical Guide to Relieving Pain, Reducing Stress and Restoring Wellbeing. And I've co-written that with a guy called Danny Penman, who's a journalist. I did another book that came out in 2008 that's called Living Well with Pain and Illness, which I was very happy with, and it's helped many people. However, the thing that I've become less and less happy with in terms of mindfulness coming into society is that generally, it's still been at the level where it's reaching the middle class, educated people.
Yeah,
I think when something's quite new, or it's something's new in terms of it being a new application. Obviously, mindfulness isn't new. Mindfulness has been around for thousands of years, but in terms of it transitioning from the religious enclave to the general population.
Yeah,
that's new. And very often, when things are new, it's the middle class, educated people who are thrashing it out, if you like. They're working out the conceptual aspects.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
So it is becoming more and more well-known, but it tends to be middle-class educated people. And there's lots of evidence that poor health is associated with lower socioeconomic status.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone has poor health, but the people who have lower socioeconomic status tend to have poorer health. So here I was developing a mindfulness program for health conditions, and my previous book just wasn't getting to the people that really needed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's ridiculous. You know, why should people who maybe are not so able or used to reading books, why should they not benefit from mindfulness?
Mm-hmm.
So Danny is a journalist who's extremely good at writing for the general population.
Mm-hmm.
He writes for the Daily Mail. So he really knows how to reach across lots of social barriers.
Yeah.
And he'd written a previous book with Professor Mark Williams, who developed mindfulness-based cognitive therapy.
Mm-hmm.
So they teamed up and did a book called Mindfulness, How to Find Peace in a Frantic World. And that's been very, very successful. So I approached Danny to see if he'd be interested in doing a book applying mindfulness to health conditions. and he was happy to do that. So that's what the second book is. So we've tried to make it really, really simple. It's got a CD in the back, so you can do an 8-week program just by buying the book.
Fantastic.
Lots of case studies.
Yeah.
The science in it. It's got quite a lot of science in it, but it's all very science for the layman kind of language.
And have you thought about any particular strategies to target that specific audience?
Well, it's interesting. Just today, in fact, there's been an article in the Mail on Sunday. So Danny's written some articles. There's one in today. There'll be another one in next Sunday and then the following Sunday. And I just looked at the Amazon rankings just before coming on, and I think it's our book something like 490 on the Amazon rankings now, which is very, very good, because Amazon's got millions of titles. And I think a few days ago I looked and it was about 2,000. So I would guess quite a lot of people have bought it today based on the Mail on Sunday article. We're hoping to eventually get it books on prescription, so doctors will prescribe it to people. We're doing lots of promotion. Now, it's quite interesting in terms of my vision, which is to reach as many people as possible, that writing a book that's mainly words at all is possibly missing the target audience. So mm-hmm. I've also got quite some part of my vision for my work and Breathworks is to maybe do an illustrated book next. And then maybe after that to do a computer game.
Right.
Because a lot of people don't read at all. They just don't read books anymore. And it's been a fascinating experience co-writing a book with a journalist. And I think we've done well to maintain the integrity of the ideas.
Right, but yeah, and
very, very accessible.
Smashing. Okay, I noticed that Jon Kabat-Zinn, arguably the founder of mindfulness-based stress reduction, he was very complimentary about your book. In the approach that you take to mindfulness, is it very similar to his, or do you differ in any significant way?
So Jon Kabat-Zinn founded something called Mindfulness-Based Stress Reduction, or MBSR, and that came out of his work in the late 70s in America.
Yeah.
And he managed to get into a hospital setting to do the work.
Yeah.
He was taking people who were falling through the cracks in the healthcare system. Yeah. It's excellent work that he's done. And when I first came across his work in the 90s, I was very taken by it because by that point I'd had many, many years of meditation experience. And yet here was this guy who was particularly looking at, well, how do you meditate when your body hurts?
Yeah.
So I hadn't really got much guidance on that within my formal meditation training. So I loved his work. And I think I would have trained in MBSR if I could have. But at that point, you couldn't do it in this country. So the only way you could train in MBSR was to go to America and do what was called an internship in Massachusetts. And I couldn't do that. My back was far too bad. You know, I was too disabled and I didn't have any money. So that was out of the question. So I thought, well, I can't do MBSR. I'll have to invent something else. So partly Breathworks has got some distinctive differences from MBSR. But it wasn't that I developed Breathworks in reaction to MBSR. It was more, yeah, I thought, well, I can't do that because I can't train in it. I can't just buy a book and then say I'm an MBSR trainer, because that felt completely unethical. So I thought, well, I have to really look inside on my own experience. What have I learned as somebody who'd been meditating with quite severe physical pain for decades? And what were the distinctive things that I could bring to this work?
Yeah.
So I would say that Breathworks is, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe 80% the same as MBSR. But there are four distinct areas where we're a wee bit different.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is that we have a compassion practice central to our program. And that's very, very important. That partly pragmatically, I'd always balanced mindfulness practice with compassion practice about equally in my own meditation training, and found that very, very helpful. And I saw no reason to change that by developing a mindfulness course. So in MBSR, compassion is implicitly there in the program.
Yeah.
But there aren't formal compassion practices taught very much. There's a little bit, but not very much. whereas we've got compassion practices absolutely central to our program. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is we do a lot of work on the actual breath. So we do work on the physiology of breathing, trying to help people improve their breathing. Because if you've got discomfort, mentally, emotionally, or physically, you will also have breath holding. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And so just to give an example for you and for the listeners, if you just make a fist with one hand now, so just make a fist with one hand, and what's happened to your breath?
I've stopped.
You've stopped. And that's what we do, okay? That's what anybody does. Now, if you go back to the fist, and imagine directing your breathing into the fist. And what does the fist want to do?
Relax.
It wants to relax, exactly.
Oh, interesting.
So that fist is a metaphor for physical pain. So if you've got discomfort in the body, it's as if you've got fists around your body. And you'll not just have the discomfort, but you'll have breath holding. And then if you've got breath holding, you've got secondary tension. You've got poorer delivery of oxygen to the cells. Poorer release of carbon dioxide, and that will make you feel more tired, more stressed, more strained, and so on. So we do quite a lot of work around how to breathe more optimally. So that's very, very important. We do a whole module on what we call pacing, because a lot of people with chronic health conditions are quite irregular in the way they use their energy. So you wake up one morning and you feel really good, you're having a good day, and you do all the housework, you do all the shopping, you go mad because you're having a good day, and then you crash the next day.
Yeah.
And that's called boom and bust. So a lot of us are stuck in a boom and bust cycle.
Yeah.
Overdoing it on a good day and then having a relapse as a consequence. So we've got a whole module that takes maybe 3 weeks where people keep diaries of all their activities for 1 week, what their pain levels were at the end, what their stress levels were at the end, how long they did that activity for, and whether it made their pain worse, better, or no difference.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite detailed
analysis
of your actual behavior in your life.
And that encouragement of the reflection is a big part of the process as well, is it?
Definitely, yeah. Just trying to get much closer to how do I actually live my life? Because it's all very well to meditate for 20 minutes a day, 30 minutes a day.
Yeah.
That's a good thing to do. But if you go mad the rest of the day, then actually your meditation isn't really going to change your life very much.
Yeah.
So you need to bring mindfulness into your daily life. That's absolutely essential for proper behavior change and quality of life change.
So when you're actually actively sitting or whatever you encourage, you see that as a sort of litmus paper in a way to blend into the rest of your day.
That's right, yeah. And what we do is when people have kept their diaries, eventually after some more steps in the process, we encourage people to start using a timer. So for example, I've learned through this kind of work that if I sit for longer than 20 minutes, then my back will flare up.
Yeah.
So now I use a timer. So if I'm in meetings, I'll set my timer and I'll stand up after 20 minutes. If I'm working at my computer, I'll do the same thing. If I'm giving a public talk, I'll do the same thing.
Okay.
And by learning to interrupt my activities with a change of posture, that's massively decreased my pain levels.
Okay. Can I just go back to something you said about the compassionate mindfulness? Do you use similar techniques that they use in Buddhism, like loving kindness meditation or things like that?
Yeah, it's all based on the loving kindness meditation.
Yeah. Yes. And are you familiar with Paul Gilbert's work at all?
Yeah, I'm very impressed by Paul Gilbert's work. So we brought some of that into our mindfulness work.
Right.
In fact, we've been doing it for 10 years. That's what's quite interesting. In the mindfulness field, it kind of started to take off in this country about 2000.
Yeah.
About when we were starting. And there's been, you know, a lot of research studies done and show it and so on, showing it's effective. And now, over the last couple of years, there's been people recognizing the need for compassion.
Right.
So it's enormous mindfulness work, and now we've got compassion coming along. Well, we've in fact been doing both for 10 years. So we've seen both as central pillars, if you like, right from the start. And so it's just quite interesting to watch that development, that people are now, some people are recognizing that there needs to be more overt compassion practices within mindfulness modalities, which is I would totally agree with. Because
yeah.
it's not just compassion towards yourself, but the other thing that can happen with mindfulness practice, paradoxically, is we can become a little over focused on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
It can be all about me and my mind and my behavior and my body and I want to be happier,
yeah.
Which can become rather a self-centered occupation.
Yeah.
And the thing about the loving kindness meditations that we do is you're actively thinking of other people.
Right.
So you will do work on yourself, but then you think of other people, people around you, people in the world. So you're using reflection to turn your discomfort or your pain from a moment of isolation from humanity to a moment of empathy with humanity.
Yeah. So then balance is also an important part of the process then.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
About self and others. So you're really starting to work on your relationship with self and other as well.
Yeah. Okay. There seems to be a growing amount of evidence supporting the benefits of mindfulness. If there was no empirical evidence, would you still practice mindfulness and promote it?
Well, the quick answer is yes, definitely. The reason I say that is because really the only reason why I founded Breathworks and I offer the courses and have written the books and so on is because I know from my own experience that it works.
Yeah.
So I always say about Breathworks is it's an organization or it's a program that's developed from the inside out. So you could say, here I was as a young woman with spinal pain, disability. There wasn't any medical cure or even really very effective treatment for my situation. I was lucky enough to be taught meditation. I realized that my mind was a tool that I could train.
Yeah.
Then that's what I've been doing for the last 30 years. And I know it works. So that's the whole basis for what we've developed. So then I had this interesting situation where I wanted to offer it to other people, partly because I thought back to this poor young woman lying in a hospital bed in New Zealand in 1985, where I wasn't really offered anything other than sending the chaplain around, which was amazing. But mind-body medicine, or integrative medicine as it's now called, that just was not around in 1985. So I wasn't offered anything. So I wanted to try to develop something so that other people wouldn't have to go through the lonely journey that I've had to go through.
Yeah.
So here I was, I had this experience, I knew it worked, and I thought, well, I'll try and teach it to other people. So in 2001, I started running some courses with a very, very, very small grant from the Millennium Commission. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I was just kind of making it up as I went along. And it worked. It was like, well, it doesn't just work for me, it works for other people. That's amazing.
Yeah.
And then after a few years, me and my colleagues, we had the obvious realization that three people working in Manchester, we can maybe help, I don't know, 100 people a year. But there's millions of people. One in seven people in the UK have got chronic pain. So there's millions of people who could benefit from this work.
Are you talking about physical and emotional?
No, just physical.
Just physical pain.
One in seven.
So that's not including people?
No. Anxiety and depression. If you bring in anxiety and depression and chronic health conditions, it's an epidemic out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we realized that the most effective way we could get this work out was to teach other people to do it. So
yeah.
To train other teachers. So really we've become more of a training organization over the last 6 years or so. And we run quite an in-depth training program. People can look at our website for more information about that. The web address is www.breathworks-mindfulness.org.uk. And then we had this interesting situation. It's quite curious how it happened that we had something that worked. We were teaching other people to teach others. So then we had to come up with a whole theoretical model. Because if you're going to teach other people, you have to have a convincing theoretical model.
Of course, yeah.
But in my experience, the theoretical model was entirely secondary to the pragmatic knowledge that this is an effective method.
Yeah.
And I'm quite willing, in a way, to change the theoretical model. If something better comes along, well, I will change it and adapt it.
Yeah.
So it's not a modality that's research-driven or theory-driven, and then you test that out on real people. It's pragmatically driven.
Yeah.
Now it works on real people, so then we've got to come up with some kind of, you know, rationale for that.
So it's based on
people. It's completely based on experience.
Well, that ties very much in with the middle way, really.
So even if, you know, if there wasn't an evidence base out there, I would still do it. Yeah. Definitely. I know it works.
Okay. But it does appear that there is evidence out there, quite a lot of evidence. Just going back to you saying that if people are not careful, they can become too person focused. Could this evidence in a way contribute to that? Could it be seen as a hindrance if you're not careful? Could it encourage people to approach it from a sort of very left brain, goal oriented perspective rather than a more integrative self, other, more holistic perspective?
I think there's a danger of that. I think whenever anything becomes popular, I think far more people will benefit, and there'll be some people who corrupt it. I think that's just the nature of these things. If something becomes popular, then you don't quite know where it's going to go. And I think because human beings don't like to suffer, then people will approach mindfulness. Some people will approach mindfulness just to feel better.
Mm-hmm.
Be like, oh, great, I'll do this, and then I won't have pain anymore, or I'll be happy all the time. And so there's quite a sort of limited perspective in there. I mean, obviously, that's reasonable not to want to suffer, of course.
Yeah.
But mindfulness in its true sense is a much deeper transformation, where we become less selfish, more integrated into the human condition. We were able to see our own experience reflected in the 7 billion other people on the planet around us.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully we become more loving, more generous, kinder, and so on.
Yeah.
Which is a much bigger perspective than if I practice mindfulness, my back pain might hurt less.
Yeah.
Which is a much more kind of selfish, small goal, if you like.
Yeah.
So I think there's a danger. But I also think there is something about awareness practice and mindfulness practice. It is by its very nature transformative. So I think if you do truly practice it, you will change in ways that perhaps you didn't bargain for.
I don't know if you heard of Stephen Batchelor, the secular Buddhist.
Yes.
He sees mindfulness in the health service or in the wider world as a sort of Trojan horse to get people to potentially see things from a wider perspective.
Well, I think that's very interesting because, you know, I'm an ordained Buddhist as well as a secular mindfulness teacher, which is a very interesting situation to live within. I don't actually have any conflict, but I sometimes have an image which I find quite evocative for myself, that I see my work within my Buddhist tradition like being there's a blazing sun.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dark sky and there's a blazing sun, and that work within the Buddhist tradition is like sitting at the sun. You know, I've got the complete package. I've got ritual, I've got ethics, I've got a goal, I've got highly sophisticated meditation practices.
Yeah.
I've got a philosophical framework, yeah. And then you've got the darkness of the suffering in the world. And I see my work at Breathworks as like where that light intersects with the darkness.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's way out in the world, intersecting with the darkness, and that's a very, very valuable and important place to work.
Uh-huh.
So and I'm lucky in that I have both. And recently, I've been doing quite a lot of drop-in and beginner meditation courses at the Manchester Buddhist Centre.
Yeah.
And I've been amazed at the demographic of people coming. A few years ago when I did it, it was mostly middle-aged people, I would say. None of this is pejorative, it's just an observation.
Yeah.
And now it's a lot of young people. There's a lot of young people coming who are coming because they're anxious, they're feeling stressed,
mm-hmm.
those kind of things. And I would guess, this is just a guess, that a lot of them are there because of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Because mindfulness has popularized meditation. And now it's okay to go through a Buddhist center. It's not such a weird thing to do years ago.
Why do you think it is out there, mindfulness? How has it got out there?
Well, I think it's got out there because of the scientists. That's what's very interesting. You know, we do live in a very scientific society. You know, you could some people say science is the new God.
Mm-hmm.
So we're the prevailing stance, I would guess, is scientific materialism. You know, that's what many of us have been brought up with. So the fact that there's an explosion of studies into mindfulness within the scientific literature, that means that doctors, psychologists, all these kind of people who have been trained within that paradigm of trusting an evidence base, a scientific evidence base, well, they've now got the data, so then they trust it because there's the data, and it means that they will start to bring it into their work and it becomes popular. So I think there's two ways you can look at it, that there's two Trojan horses at work here. One Trojan horse is science. So science is a Trojan horse to get any kind of mind training into society. And then I would say that the secular mindfulness boom is a bit of a Trojan horse for people to access higher spiritual values, to use that term.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so just developing that a little bit further, and we've touched on ethics a little bit, how do you think mindfulness practices relate to the middle way?
Well, I think with mindfulness practice, if you're sitting to meditate every day, or you're lying on your bed doing a body scan or whatever it is, you're going to become more aware. That's what's going to happen, because that's what mindfulness practice is. You're going to become more aware of your body, more aware of your thoughts, and more aware of your emotions. You know, it might be that initially you just become aware that you're really tense.
Yeah.
You feel really blocked or very resistant, whatever it is. But that is awareness dawning. And that means you will become more integrated, and you'll become a person who's, as you bring more stuff into awareness, you can then process it, and you can then integrate it within your psyche, within your consciousness. And that means you're no longer going to be a person who's so polarized within yourself.
Yeah.
And then that means you'll be a person who's less polarized with the world around you. And I think we can call this integration, and you can look at it both on what we could call a horizontal and vertical level. The horizontal is where you become more aware of different aspects of your conscious mind.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you might become aware of your thoughts, and you realize that you have thoughts of anger that maybe you weren't really even that aware of before.
Yeah.
And being aware of an angry thought is very different from being lost in an angry thought.
Okay. Yeah.
You say, wow, that's an angry thought, as opposed to, I hate that person.
Yeah.
That's quite a shift.
There is a difference there, definitely.
Yeah. And then I think the vertical integration is more where you become aware of what's in your unconscious. It kind of bubbles up, or your subconscious, it bubbles up into your conscious mind. And you can also become aware of sort of higher states of mind, you know, at times when you're feeling very clear, happy, loving, and so on. So I think mindfulness is by its nature very integrating.
Okay. Yeah.
Particularly when it's combined with these loving kindness and compassion practices.
Yeah.
And that means you're going to become a less conflicted person internally and with the world around you, which is more of a middle way approach, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Given that you teach mindfulness practices beyond the Buddhist tradition, what do you think of the idea of the middle way as a whole being taught beyond the Buddhist tradition?
Well, again, as I've been saying earlier on, I'm a tremendous pragmatist. So I think if the middle way is a method where people can sort of grow and develop as human beings, take their place in humanity within a skillful and generous and loving way, then wonderful. The world is desperate for ways to bring harmony. You know, the world's in a terrible state, isn't it? So the world is desperate for anything that's going to enable people to become more whole, more integrated, more positive, less conflicted, you know, conflicted both within themselves and with the world around them. And if the middle way is one way of doing that, then I think wonderful, you know. I think my philosophy, and it is really very simple, is if it works, do it. So that will be the litmus test. Does it work?
Okay, well, I think on that note, Vidya Mala, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating interview, and good luck with your venture.
Thanks very much, Barry. It's been great talking to you.
You can find out more about Middle Way philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.